welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we are covering the Constitution, so the Constitutional Convention, James Madison's notes, just so you can hear the layout, or as they kind of formulate this new form of government in creating the Constitution and migrating, or I should say, kind of folding in those powers that were in the Articles of Confederation and providing some new powers, i.e. taxation, so that this new government would be able to succeed in doing what it needed to do to serve the Union. So with that, I mean, this is all about constitutional compliance, folks. And you can't ask your public servants to be compliant if you don't know what they're supposed to be doing to be compliant. So it's why we do this, and this is why, hopefully, we give you insights and understanding to help be more efficacious in the cause of liberty. Anywho, welcome back, Sean. And
good to be here, sir. Thank you.
No problem. Happy to have you. And what we are going to dive into, folks, is where we left off yesterday. And that is on page 264. And we're starting towards the bottom with Mr. Dickinson. And if you're using the same document that I put up, it's already kind of highlighted. This is blue highlighting. And this is where we talk about property and representation. And again, they're still talking about these basic issues this far into it. And you're going to notice that these issues really don't go away until they start wrapping up the last month. And it's still there. Anyway, so Mr. Dickinson of Delaware, go ahead, and if you would pick that up, Sean, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Dickinson of Delaware had a very different idea of the tendency of vesting the right of suffrage in the freeholders of the country. He considered them as the best guardians of liberty, and the restriction of the right to them as a necessary defense against the dangerous influence of those multitudes without property and without principle, with which our country, like all others, will in time abound. As to the unpopularity of the innovation, it was, in his opinion, chimerical. The great mass of our citizens is composed at this time of freeholders and will be pleased with it.
And I think that's chimerical, I think. And I think if you look it up, it's kind of like something that takes multiple shapes and forms.
Yeah, chimera.
Yeah.
I've never seen that use of it.
Right. Well, yeah, it's the, I guess it's the characteristics of the creature. So anyway. Okay, so Mr. Ellsworth then pipes in from North Carolina, or actually not from North Carolina. So Mr. Dickinson from Delaware, now Mr. Ellsworth from Connecticut. Go ahead.
How shall the freehold be defined? Ought not every man who pays a tax to vote for the representative who is to levy and dispose of his money? Shall the wealthy merchants and manufacturers who will bear a full share of the public burdens be not allowed a voice in the imposition of them? Taxation and representation ought to go together.
Yep. Okay. And that was the whole point of the revolution and the business decision of King George. Okay, so now Mr. Governor Morris pipes in, and obviously he's been, you know, kind of showing his cards that, you know, I'm changing my mind just due to the fact that we're gonna persist with this slavery and this representation for slaves, we're gonna maintain the sovereignty of the states and the Senate. But let's go ahead and see what he says here.
He had long learned not to be the dupe of his words. The sound of aristocracy, therefore, had no effect on him. It was the thing, not the name, to which he was opposed. And one of his principal objections to the Constitution, as it is now before us, is that it threatens this country with an aristocracy. The aristocracy will grow out of the House of Representatives. Give the votes to people who have no property, and they will sell them to the rich who will be able to buy them. We should not confine our attention to the present moment. The time is not distant when this country will abound with mechanics and manufacturers who will receive their bread from their employers. Will such men be secure and faithful guardians of liberty? Will they be in the impregnable barrier against aristocracy? He was as little duped by the association of the words taxation and representation. The man who does not give his vote freely is not representative, not represented. It is the man who dictates the vote. Children do not vote. Why? Because they want prudence, because they have no will of their own. The ignorant and the dependent can be as little trusted with the public interest. He did not conceive the difficulty of defining freeholders to be inseparable, still less that the restriction could be unpopular. 9/10 of the people are at present freeholders, and these will certainly be pleased with it. As to merchants, etc., if they have wealth and value the right, they can acquire it. If they do, if not, they don't deserve it.
Okay, so with a little snapshot, I don't know how accurate, but 9/10 of the people were freeholders, and that's due to the fact that at that point in time, they were, you know, they weren't bringing people in as indentured servants anymore, but they were making it easy for people to actually acquire land so that they could contribute. Because productive people in the community help bring commodities, goods, and things that are useful and a benefit to the community. People that come in and say, give me this, give me this, give me this, then those people become a drain on the community. Now, he makes this comment that this, you're going down this path, that the, and it says here, give the votes to the people who have no property, and they will sell them to the rich who will be able to buy them. Well, if that's the case, then what we're looking at really is qualified as a democratic republic. And what that means is that the people can just at the will, you know, give us food, give us, you know, jobs, give us handouts, you know, build a home for us, give us phones. If the people can ask their politicians for stuff and the politicians can give it to them, and they do give it to them, that is a democratic republic where they have representatives and the people dictate what they want. In other words, there's no constitution that's limiting. It's almost like as we look at general powers being granted to the king, in a democratic republic, general powers are granted to the public, which goes back to this whole concept of why Tytler's cycle of democracy was not applicable in America. It couldn't happen here because the constitution was very limited and defined. The people just couldn't come along and say, give us something, because the authority to do that has to be in the Constitution. As Mr. Morris is kind of alluding to, that they'd be able to do that, I'm of the opinion that they haven't formed this concept of a limited and defined Constitution. Maybe they still have in their mind that they're creating kind of a general constitution or a constitution with general powers. Now, one would think with the Articles of Confederation being very limited and defined and that they were trying to cling to that they would actually have that in their head. It eludes me how some of these men that were in this process could throw these ideas up. Does that make sense? I mean, how is it that they're in their elbows in the thick of this, and they're coming up with these ideas that just they don't apply, that they would have this democratic republic? Right, Sean? I mean, am I making sense?
Yes, sir. And I think it struck me what he was talking about is not necessarily voting in what they want, like give us money and we all vote for you giving us money and you give us money. But it would be like they'd be able to consolidate power because the rich would buy up all the votes like they do now. You know, they go around and get people to get their votes and to get elected so that then they can go in and they'll have the power of this voting block because they bought all the votes. So then they'll have leverage.
Okay. So
just a note on what I thought about when I heard him say that.
Okay. So
the rich will buy up the votes.
Okay. So let's say they have all the votes. The only thing that they can do with those votes is not have to worry about compromising whether they're going to declare war, not having to worry about compromise. In other words, if you have all the votes, then you don't need to worry about compromise. You're going to get what you want. We're going to go to war, and we're going to make these changes to a uniform rule of naturalization. In other words, they're now going to be able to apply with, you know, giving them a majority control over those things granted. They're now going to be able to apply those things that they want to do, but that's it. What harm other than, you know, they may be, you know, war hawks, they may be, you know, pacifists and maybe make the nation kind of vulnerable to an attack. I don't know, but I mean, it's not like they're going to be able to become spendthrifts and go out and just spend money on things that they have no authority to do. There's still that limitation.
Right. I get your point. It's a limited constitution. So no matter who gets in there, they should only have the power and authority to do these specific things.
Right. So if you understand that, then the question is, what are term limits going to do? If we're not holding them accountable to the few things and making sure that they're operating only within the powers granted, what do term limits do? Term limits don't solve the problem. We have to hold them accountable to the powers granted. Term limits will not do that. So, in other words, the next person that comes in will be able to be a part of the populace and, you know, give the people what they want when they don't have the authority to do it. Until we demand and hold them accountable to the limited powers granted, then, you know, the term limits do nothing. And all it will do is it will create an administrative process that makes sure that a person cannot have a succession of terms or is limited to a very specific number of terms. That's it. That's all that they've done. They've done no good, and in some cases they may have done harm. And I say that because there have been men since the beginning of this nation that have served. And they gave a lifetime in serving with the best of principles, like John Quincy Adams, in fighting to stop slavery. Okay, so we would never have a John Quincy Adams again, which basically waters are down and almost makes it impossible for good things to kind of drive for change for the good. Now, it doesn't mean you can't have bad change, try to drive for the bad, but here's the real problem with bad change. Bad change still requires 3/4 of the states to go along with it. Like, they're going to take all of our guns. Well, you've got to get 38 states to be able to, you know, take away the guns, to remove the Second Amendment. That's what it takes, folks. So you only need 13 states currently to hold the line and say, you shall not take our guns. And it's the problem solved. It's over. No discussion. You can't do it. So, again, when we really look at this, there's so much fear. The way people look at this big monstrosity of government, the big monstrosity is all a part of the, I'll just say, it's the facade. It is the tyranny. It is these unconstitutional assumptions of roles, responsibilities, powers, and so forth. It all needs to be stripped away because they don't have the authority to do these things. They don't have the authority to keep on spending the money that's ratcheting up our debt. Now, they do have the authority to execute war. But, if they execute war, they're limited to those powers that they can use to execute war. They do not have the power to deploy, you know, Air Force, Army, you know, outside the United States. And they do not have the power to, spend the money in maintaining that. I mean, if we're gonna go to war, and I guess this kind of opens up that, and I didn't really necessarily want to open up a rat hole. But bottom line, because we've covered this before, you know, when a nation or a people or a ideology declares war on the world, does that mean we're not at war?
No.
Okay. That means that if we don't understand and respond in kind, then we're opening ourselves up for some significant loss of property, life, what have you. In other words, we're going to be harmed. We have to take it seriously when people declare war. And the Nation of Islam has declared war upon the world way back in its founding. We're going to take over the world. Hey, world, take notice. These people are serious. And at what point in time have we ever seen them not be serious? When they've obtained a point where they believe they have a level of control, even in America where they can't have this control, and they go bat crap crazy. And I'm going, hold on here. What they're doing is literally unconstitutional. Why is this not being stopped? Because we've lost our senses. Because we're so illiterate, we are actually aiding our own demise. Because we don't understand that they can't do these things. They shouldn't even be here. They can't even be citizens. But the point is that outside of here, they've declared war. And if we're not acting in kind, that we're actually at war with this ideology. And, you know, the only reason this ideology has been able to flourish all of this time is because we've actually had leaders who have deliberately dismissed it so that they could, it's kind of like America making China the most favored nation status. But in so doing, we knew, I'm talking in sentence fragments, but this is going to start making sense. There's a meme going around in social media, and I've seen it a few times. And the meme basically says the facts are, you know, that Obama gave Iran money for buying weapons, and that's not true. The money that that Iran got was money that was theirs. Well, okay, so they go out of their way to try to prove this case that all the money that they ended up getting was money that they were supposed to have be due to contract, what have you. And the question is whether we had the authority to negate those. That's another, that they don't address that. And the other thing that they don't address within the meme, within this line of facts, is what did Iran do with the money they got from Obama? Because the second side of this accusation or this assertion is that they spent it on war. They spent it on weapons. In other words, they didn't say that they didn't. What did Iran do with that money? It's the same thing with China. When we gave them most favored nation status and they started actually being able to make money to pull themselves out of the ditch and create, you know, this industrious machine that they have become. Well, okay, hold on here. What have they been doing with that money? They've been building a war machine. Now, they have their own, China has a space station. China is very serious in space and in technology and everything else, thanks to you and your tax dollars and Nixon and every president since then that has basically ignored the fundamental fact that China is in business to destroy us. So it sure makes sense to just ignore that and continue to do business with China. I mean, I remember reading a book. Actually, I never read it. I just skimmed through it. But it's a very alarming, and I think it's a 30-year strategy. This came out like in the late 90s, that China kind of exposed, or somebody exposed the Chinese's 30-year strategy of how they would become the dominant nation of the world. And they weren't going to do it technically militarily. But in the backside, they were going to create the military so that by the time they have gotten towards their 20th and 30th year, that China would then have enough military production of jets and ships and so forth that, you know, you'd better think twice if you really want to go kick the dragon. And they weren't looking to take over the world by war. They were looking to take over the world by subjugation, by going in and helping poor countries and basically coming in and controlling them and bringing them, colonizing them as a colony of China. And what we see around the world, all these nations that are Chinese controlled, it's because they've been subjugated and China now controls them. Now, that's neither here nor there. The point is this. Is that when we declare war, then that means something. But when another nation declares war, that doesn't mean anything? No, it's got to mean something, folks. And so when we look at the power granted to government, and there is these things out there that, you know, these entities that are at war with us, the fact that they ignore that, that's one of the things that they should be doing. But snap, environmental and energy policies, all of these things that they don't have the power to do, they shouldn't be doing those things. So getting out of this rat hole, hopefully that helped a little bit. But the point is that this constitution was built and designed so that government couldn't run away. It was contingent upon one thing to make sure that that would never happen. And that contingency is you. You have to hold them accountable to those powers granted, keeping them within the few powers granted, and that's it. You know, it's kind of like your child, you know, no, don't touch that. And making sure that the things they're not supposed to touch, they don't touch. And what happens when you allow them to touch things that then they get broken, somebody gets hurt, something gets damaged, you know, the house burns down. That's why you have to hold them accountable. And you want to make sure that they don't put their hands on those things. They don't even come close. This is one of the reasons why it was brought up in the ratification debates that it would be incumbent upon the state legislatures to create oversight checks, you know, looking and seeing what are they doing? Is this within their powers and holding them accountable? And it was all good. The problem was that these guys that they sent into the federal government weren't a bunch of strangers. They're people that they knew, people that they respected. The people that went into the federal government was the best and the brightest. This was a huge honor. And these men that went there, it was a permanent honor, basically, because the only reason that they would not go back in the next session is because they fell from grace. Now, or they chose not to go anymore. I know Madison in, I think 97 was his last year, because in 98 he wasn't serving. He didn't run for election and didn't serve again. So, and I think that really was because more of preparing for what him and Jefferson had to do with the resolutions of 98 and so forth. Anyway, we're going into break. So when we come back, we're going to move forward into Colonel Mason's comments regarding property, land, and so forth. But hopefully you're starting to see that, you know, even at this point, you know, we're on the downside of this Constitutional Convention, and these delegates are still thinking that there's these unlimited powers that they're granting. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I'm drying off. I'm out of the swimming pool here, or this little rat hole that I was swimming in. And we're getting back to these comments. It just, I'll try not to use that as a trigger. When I see these delegates who are working, they're elbows deep in this Constitution, where they're only delegating certain powers. But they're alluding to this idea that they're going to be able to do all sorts of things, like we just read with Governor Morris. And I'm going, that doesn't pass my smell test. But anyway, so Sean, let's keep going with Colonel Mason and Virginia.
Colonel Mason, we all feel too strong.
Did I lose you?
No, sir.
Okay. Was there something that you had conscientious objection to what you were reading or a thought that came
no,
up?
No, sir. I started reading and you broke in and stopped me.
Oh, actually, I didn't say anything. So,
okay. Maybe it was the echo I was hearing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That. So you got it. I hate it when I get the echo. So I apologize. By all means, continue. Thank you.
We all feel too strongly the remains of ancient prejudices and view things too much through a British medium. A freehold is a qualification in England, and hence it is imagined to be the only proper one. The true idea, in his opinion, was that every man having evidence of attachment to and a permanent common interest with the society ought to share in all its rights and privileges. Was this qualification restrained to freeholders? Does no other kind of property but land evidence a common interest in the proprietor? Does nothing besides property mark a permanent attachment? Ought the merchant, the moneyed man, the parent of a number of children whose fortunes are to be pursued in his own county, to be viewed as suspicious characters and unworthy to be trusted with the common rights of their fellow citizens?
Now, you've got to have some feelings about this, what he said here.
Well, I kind of agree with him. I mean,
I know you do, because we've had this conversation.
Yeah.
We've talked about,
I mean, they shouldn't be able to enact laws on someone who has no right to be represented in those laws.
Right.
They
shouldn't
be able to tax you if you don't have a right to representation.
Or you shouldn't have to go to war. They shouldn't. You know, if they're going to make decisions and you get no representation, then you shouldn't have to suffer the consequences of the decisions they make and what government is going to do. It should not affect you.
It should do you no liberty.
Harm. Right, correct.
If someone's making decisions that affect your life and you have no say in it, you might as well be a slave.
Right. And so I've gotten to a point where I believe everybody should be able to vote for their representative. But I don't believe that when it comes to creating specific tax on specific types of property, like, you know, commercial and residential taxes for school levies, then I don't think that if you don't own property, you shouldn't be able to vote in that. It's kind of like stock. If you don't own the stock, then you can't vote in the governance or the decisions that are being made at the governing level. So
that, then you're voting for somebody else's property. You're voting to give away or take someone else's property, and yours isn't affected.
And the reason why they want non-property holders to be able to vote in these things, because they're the ones that will throw caution to the wind and say, take it from them, because I have none. Right. And that's how we make these types of mistakes. This goes back to understanding, you know, these fundamental principles. If you don't have a dog in the fight, then you shouldn't even be in the ring. Anyway, Mr. Madison now kind of pipes in. And let's see what he says now that Mason basically talked about freeholders, property, and everything else. Go ahead.
The right of suffrage is certainly one of the fundamental articles of Republican government and ought not to be left to be regulated by the legislature. A gradual abridgment of this right has been the mode in which aristocracies have been built on the ruins of popular forms. Whether the constitutional qualification ought to be a freehold would with him depend much on the probable reception such a change would meet within the states, where the right was now exercised by every description of people. In several of the states, a freehold was now the qualification. Viewing the subject in its merits alone, the freeholders of the country would be the safest depositories of the Republican liberty. In future times, a great majority of the people would not only be without landed, but any sort of property. These will either combine under the influence of their common situation, in which case the rights of property and the public liberty would not be secure in their hands, or, which is more probable, they will become the tools of opulence and ambition, in which case there will be equal danger on another side. The example of England had been misconceived by Colonel Mason. A very small proportion of the representatives are there chosen by freeholders. The greatest part are chosen by the cities and boroughs, in many of which the qualification of suffrage is as low as it is in any of the U.S., and it was in the boroughs and cities rather than the counties that bribery most prevailed, and the influence of the crown on elections was most dangerously exerted.
Okay, so as Madison kind of points out, and he talks about this change that eventually we're going to become a society where people won't own land. Well, I don't think we've gotten there. I mean, what's the percentage of homes or families that currently percentages of owning their own home? How many renters in our society that are families that are destined to be renters and never own property? I mean, it's pretty low, isn't it? What do you think, Sean?
I'm looking it up right now. 65% of American households own the home in which they live, according to the census.
What is it, 5%?
No, 65%.
Oh, 65% are people in the process of purchasing a home. Okay, purchasing a home.
No, people who own their home.
Okay. And out of the 35%, how many of them are in a financial position like they just got married, they're young? Because there was a long period of time in my life where I was not in the process of acquiring property for myself. So there's, you know, there's this transition period where it takes a person where they feel like, you know, they've got their ducks in a row to be able to buy that property. So, you know, there's kind of like this magical line where, you know, you can actually get a mortgage because you need a certain amount of income. You need to have a certain amount of income to debt, or have to have a low debt ratio to your income. So those people that are, you know, spending, even if they wanted to have, they could not get it because of their behavior. And so they have to kind of mature and stop spending and start saving and those types of things to become a landholder, right? So the bottom line is we're still over 50%. And this is, you know, 2.5 centuries beyond. So, yeah, we have migrated towards a greater percentage of non-landholding families. but that doesn't mean that that's good, bad, or anything. I mean, if you, you know,
do those people actually own their homes, or does the bank own their homes?
Well, I mean, the reality is once you pull the trigger on a 30-year mortgage, you become basically the person responsible. That's your property. As long as you're making payments and stay on top of that, that's your property. Nobody bats an eye at that. And so
what about property tax?
Yeah, and that's you. The bank doesn't pay that property tax. You do. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the point is that as we kind of look at this threshold of Republican representation in our Republican form of government, the point that they're making, even though Mason, I think, was heading in the right direction. But again, if the federal government and the federal constitution was to dictate that, you know, you didn't have to be a freeholder, and all the states basically said you have to be a freeholder, what would the reception of the Constitution be? Hey, they're trying to water down, you know, our government by giving it to anybody or allowing anybody and everybody to vote in it. They would look at that as, you know, that's why ultimately what ended up happening was the standards of voting were not maintained or even established based on the federal government. When was the first amendment that actually established a standard of voting?
I'm not sure.
It's the 15th Amendment. And so it was in, I believe, late 1860s, just before 1870, which basically guaranteed that no citizen could be denied their right to vote based on race. And then the next one was, you know, several decades later, granting the right of suffrage to women. And then a half a century later, the next amendment of, you know, guaranteeing suffrage could not be denied because of a poll tax. This is where they finally stepped in and said, you can't use poll taxes to dictate whether a person could vote or not. Because they saw that as a mechanism that was denying, you know, black people and or even, you know, women, that, you know, property owners, if you couldn't pay, you couldn't vote. So let's say a widow or what have you that, you know, was strapped for money, couldn't pay the poll tax. But see, that's when property tax was voluntary. You didn't lose your home. You just couldn't vote. And I kind of like that. I kind of like that because I think there's plenty of people that don't vote. And if you don't vote, then you don't pay a property tax. And that means what that would do is it would make property tax a lower media or medium in obtaining money to fund government. That makes sense, right? In other words, this is not going to be the primary way they're going to fund government. They're only going to be funding government that they're, you know, using this tax for. Like, you know, the poll tax will only pay for basically the elections and some of that stuff, you know, and that's it. In other words, it's a mechanism of paying for this, you know, expense and function of government. And that's it. That would basically help. I think everybody would go, well, let's go back to poll taxes. Because there's a lot of people that don't vote. And I'm sure they would love to.
A lot of people that shouldn't vote.
Well, but if you understand what I'm saying, I think some of those people that you don't want to pay taxes, maybe they shouldn't be voting. That's my point. And I think that if.
But again, we come back to the issue of mm-hmm. war.
Right. But you're making
a
choice.
You have an obligation to defend the country. And they can call you to war, then you should have the right to be represented in that decision.
Okay, but that you're making the choice not to pay the poll tax to vote on that. It's not that you're being denied. You just have to pay a little tax. If you look at what you're paying on property tax, thousands of dollars and so forth, that is just outlandish. Back then, the poll tax was just a nominal tax, and it only paid for the administrative processing and handling of the election and maybe a couple of other little teeny things. It was not a major mechanism or a pipeline of bringing in lots of money for the state. Anyway, okay, so let's go with Dr. Franklin.
It is a great consequence that we should not depress the virtue and public spirit of our common people, of which they displayed a great deal during the war, and which contributed principally to the favorable issue of it. He related the honorable refusal of the American seamen who were carried in great numbers into the British prisons during the war to redeem themselves from misery or to seek their fortunes by entering on board the ships of the enemies to their country, contrasting their patriotism with a contemporary instance in which the British seamen made prisoners by the Americans readily entered onto the ships of the latter on being promised a share of the prizes that might be made out of their own country. This proceeded, he said, from the different manner in which the common people were treated in America and Great Britain. He did not think that the elected had any right in any case to narrow the privileges of the electors. He quoted as arbitrary the British statute setting forth the danger of tumultuous meetings, and under that pretext narrowing the right of suffrage to persons having freeholds of a certain value, observing that the statute was soon followed by another under a succeeding parliament, subjecting the people who had no votes to peculiar labors and hardships. He was persuaded also that such a restriction as was proposed would give great uneasiness in the populous states. The sons of a substantial farmer, not being themselves freeholders, would not be pleased at being disenfranchised, and there are a great many persons of the description.
Yeah, and so what do you think about his side? I mean, so these guys are bringing up good arguments, right? And
right.
I think that this is where, you know, when you're sitting in a vacuum and you don't have opposing ideas, you know, and I've seen this happen where, you know, the person in charge is, you know, has, I won't even say charisma, but has such a grip on the people. And as it may not even be a grip, the people may be just a bunch of sycophants because they're just a bunch of suck ups. And yeah, whatever you say, yeah, you're the greatest. However perverse, you know, this entity, group, or body of people is, however and how far off, you know, kilter they are, the point is that it's only when we actually have a diverse set of views where people can start putting things on the table to help everybody understand that in a true Republican form of government, that means that the people, and if in our form of Republicanism, we have two sovereigns, the people are sovereigns and the people's government. So we actually have a check because our government representatives will keep, you know, us from being able to grant ourselves all sorts of, you know, benefits and so forth, keep us, you know, within those powers granted. And this vice versa, there's these jealousies, these lines that will be maintained or held between these two separate legislative bodies that have literally separate interests. So it's interesting how, you know, people have these hard ideas, but how relevant is it? How relevant is it that you have to have property to be able to vote for your own representative? Well, and again, this goes back to, you know, that concept of if they can do harm, then you should have representation. So these guys have come up with some really good arguments on this. And I think that it was more than worthy of bringing this forward. So if we jump a little bit further down to 271, this is where Governor Morris. And actually, this is still, I think, the same day. No, this is August 8th, next day. And so he's talking again about property and obviously representation and so forth. So let's dive into this. This is kind of a long one, but again, let's look. Remember, Governor Morris, you know, seemed to have the old school paradigm. Because the new school paradigm seemed to be coming out of Virginia with Mason, Madison, how they were kind of talking and complaining about the prevailing thoughts and so forth. So anyway, let's go ahead and pick this one up. Thank you.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to insert free before the word inhabitants. Much he said would depend on this point. He never would concur in upholding domestic slavery. It was a nefarious institution. It was the curse of heaven on the states where it prevailed. Compare the free regions of the middle states, where rich and noble cultivation marks the prosperity and happiness of the people, with the misery and poverty which overspread the barren wastes of Virginia, Maryland, and the other states having slaves. Travel through the whole continent, and you behold the prospect continually varying with the appearance and disappearance of slavery. The moment you leave the streets and enter New York, the effects of the institution become visible. Passing through the Jerseys and entering Pennsylvania, every criterion of superior improvement witnesses the change. Proceed southwardly, and every step you take through the great region of slave presents a desert increasing, with the increasing proportion of these wretched beings. Upon what principle is that the slaves shall be computed in the representation? Are they men? Then make them citizens and let them vote. Are they property? Why then is no other property included? The house in this city, Philadelphia, are worth more than all wretched slaves which cover the rice swamps of South Carolina. The admission of slaves into the representation, when fairly explained, comes to this: that the inhabitant of Georgia and South Carolina, who goes to the coast of Africa and, in defiance of the most sacred laws of humanity, tears away his fellow creatures from their dearest connection and damns them to the most cruel bondages, shall have more votes in a government instituted for the protection of the rights of mankind than the citizen of Pennsylvania or New Jersey, who views with a laudable horror so nefarious a practice. He would add that domestic slavery is the most prominent feature in the aristocratic countenance of the proposed Constitution. The vassalage of the poor has ever been the favorite offspring of the aristocracy. And what is the proposed compensation to the northern states for a sacrifice of every principle of right, of every impulse of humanity? They are to bind themselves to march their militia for the defense of the southern states, for their defense against those very slaves of whom they complain. They must supply vessels and seamen in case of foreign attack. The legislature will have indefinite power to tax them by excises and duties on imports, both of which will fall heavier on them than on the southern inhabitants. For the boia tea used by a northern freeman will pay more tax than the whole consumption of the miserable slave, which consists of nothing more than its physical subsistence and the rag that covers his nakedness. On the other side, the southern states are not to be restrained from importing fresh supplies of wretched Africans at once to increase the danger of attack and the difficulty of defense. Nay, they are to be encouraged to it by an assurance of having their votes in the national government increased in proportion, and are at the same time to have their exports and their slaves exempt from all contributions for the public service. Let it not be said that direct taxation is to be proportioned to representation. It is idle to suppose that the general government can stretch its hand directly into the pockets of the people scattered over so vast a country. They can only do it through the medium of exports, imports, and excises. For what then are all these sacrifices to be made? He would sooner submit himself to a tax for paying for all the Negroes in the United States than saddle posterity with such a constitution.
Interesting. So, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with him. I don't understand why more people in this conference, in this convention, or why it wasn't, maybe it wasn't recorded, but I've been wondering why nobody actually stood up and made the case for the abomination that slavery was, and that they were using. How can you, on one hand, say that they should have representation, but on the other hand, they have no liberty and they're like, you know, slaves? How do you reconcile that?
So when you really, if you really read through this, because I'm only highlighting some of the, I would just say the longer orations. There are really short, succinct, you know, this is just wrong, this is, you know, but Morris, Mason, at times I think Madison and others, you know, really do a great job, but at this point in time, Governor Morris seems to be the one that's the squeaky wheel. But again, you know, he's right in these things, but he's wrong in a few other things, right? I mean, okay, so, but what he's articulating is literally laying it out that what is happening is they're literally creating a system because of the need of the union. They're literally going to allow the southern states to basically get their way. This is why he just thought this was, oh, this is such an abominable sin we're making here. And they weren't the, he was not the only one. Just remember, all these northern states, the interesting thing is that Virginia was equally critical of slavery. And they were steeped in slavery. They had plenty of slaves in Virginia, in plantations. They were willing to give it up. North Carolina was more on the fence for slavery than they were for not. But South Carolina and Georgia, they just said, you know, we can't go out in this infernal hell in the summertime and actually work for ourselves. We do not have the, you know, the constitution, the composition, physical composition to be able to go and withstand that kind of oppressive heat and conditions. And so,
was it really that, or because I get the sense that they're more concerned with their financial benefit. And like he's talking about, if they want more power in the legislature, they can just go to Africa and get some more slaves. And now all of those slaves that they brought are now part of their representation.
Right. That's exactly his point here. That right. They're basically going to be able to buy and, you know, and amass over time through investments, amass a level of control. But when we go back to what, you know, what you were saying, is it really that? I see that.
Because if you think about it, the way I see it is, it maybe they didn't have the population to, you know, provide the labor that they needed to continue their business. But if you look at your business and say, okay, I can pay these guys to do it for getting it's going to cost me this much, or I can go buy these slaves and get all the work for free.
All right, so with that, you can go and get all the work for free. And that's how we closed it, because we're literally out of time, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.